From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I'll talk with Derek Taylor. Taylor was the Beatles' press agent and helped organize the Monterey Pop Festival. His new book, It Was 20 Years Ago Today, looks back at the year Sgt. Pepper was released. Also today, we hear from Michael Crichton, author of the thrillers The Andromeda Strain, The Terminal Man, and Sphere. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Famous Blue Raincoat, Jennifer Warren's tribute to songwriter Leonard Cohen, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews River's Edge, a chilling look at a teenage murder. That's all coming up on today's edition of Fresh Air. My guest is Derek Taylor. He was the press agent for the Beatles in 1964, then returned in the late 60s as press agent for the Beatles company AppleCorps. In between, Derek Taylor lived on the West Coast in America, where he was publicist for acts like The Byrds, Captain Beefheart, Judy Collins, and the Mamas and Papas. He was also the co-founder and publicist for the Monterey Pop Festival. The festival was in 1967, the same year that the Sgt. Pepper album was released. Derek Taylor's new book, It Was 20 Years Ago Today, is about that year. It's an oral history featuring interviews with people who are at the forefront of the hippie counterculture. It Was 20 Years Ago Today is the companion to a film of the same name by Granada Television in England, and Derek Taylor was a consultant for that movie. The movie will be shown on PBS in the fall. Derek Taylor, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry.
You joined the Beatles as their press agent in 1964. Refresh our memories. What was their image in 1964? Where were they then?
Well, when I saw them first, it was at 63, they already had hits, and they were famous in Europe and still fulfilling old contracts, playing cinemas and things. I was a newspaper man for then 15 years, and so stunned by the immediacy of these people's personalities. It wasn't so much the music, though that was fascinating. My wife and I saw that this was an exotic Liverpool adventure. And we were from Liverpool, living in Manchester. And I decided I would concentrate on covering their activities. And I was still supposed to be covering ballet in the theatre and low comedians and vaudeville. But, of course, it became almost obsessive, covering the Beatles. Because as I escalated my coverage for the Daily Express, so they were starting to get more and more famous. The Royal Show followed that year. They came to America in February 64, my newspaper did not send me to cover the trip. They used the American correspondent instead. It was then I decided I had to join them. If I was going to get on the trip, I had to be with them.
So they were already pretty famous.
Oh, yes.
By the time you joined.
Yes, I wasn't a publicist when I joined them. I was a journalist. So I didn't have to make them famous.
Was there any code about their public behavior when you signed on with them in 64. I'm thinking is, for instance, when I interviewed Cynthia Lennon, she was saying that wives or girlfriends were discouraged from being seen with or identified with the Beatles because they wanted to have this image of being single and available so that all the teenage female fans could fantasize and dream about them.
Well, I don't think there was a code about them, and by the time I met them, the girlfriends were well known. Patty was, no. Patty came in Hard Day's Night, but Cynthia was known in the first American trip. Jane Asher must have been known, at least I knew. But there was a general 16 magazine kind of thesis that, hey guys, you know, hey girls, all these guys are single and always available. And there was that always that terrible feeling of loss that perhaps men of my generation had when Gene Simmons got married, and, you know, so it's too late for me. How dare she marry Stuart Granger? So that thing lasted well on into the 60s. When I went to work for the Beach Boys, very early on, I said, we're going to have you people established as married because this is pathetic that men of your age, in your mid-20s in America, should pretend to be single and even pretend to be boys.
Was it part of your job with the Beatles to protect them from the press and protect them from their fans?
No. My job with the Beatles, by the time I joined them in April 64, when they'd been to America, was to make them as available as I could. as a journalist, I had a passion to really to explain and what I was good at. I was never good at publicising people cold. I never had the guts to ring up columnists about people who were unknown. I never knew what to say about them. But the job was to try and manipulate time, available time around these available Beatles, so that you'd got a line of people with no real rights, datebook magazine reporters, young people who'd clipped out coupons and said they were newspaper reporters who weren't, and then the Time magazine and the Saturday Evening Post over there. Murray the K's had enough time. Hang on there, I'll deal with you in a moment, Murray. Ringo can talk there because these people are after Ringo. And generally speaking, try and keep them in circulation because I believe they should have been shared. They should be shared out. At the same time, you couldn't make them available all the time. And we tried to make the press conferences into an art form so that they were fun too.
You were also ghostwriting the memoirs of Brian Epstein.
On the run, on tour.
And the way I've heard it told, when you were ghostwriting with him, one afternoon he asked her to take a break from writing, and he came out, he told you that he was gay. Was that something that you and the Beatles already knew?
I hadn't discussed it with them and him. It was a dark subject then. It was illegal. I mean, it wasn't a thing that journalists were not sissies. We were men of the world. But Brian was not overtly camp. I mean, later on he would say things like, never mind that, dear, and that sort of thing. But, I mean, nobody talked like that in, you know, even in private then, because it was a very bad habit to get into because, you know, it was still illegal. But it was intolerable to him, and it was getting a bit edgy for me when he was saying that he was with a girl and she said, I'm not going to compete with these four boys. And it actually wasn't a girl who said that, it was a boy. So he broke off the taping and said, let's have lunch. And then he said at lunch, did you know I was queer, which is the word then. Gay was still a general word. And I said, well, I don't know that I did, but I don't know that I'm surprised, but it doesn't matter. So he said, well, now we've got that out of the way, I can tell you the story more easily, although there was not going to be much more in the book about that because it was still illegal. But it meant at least he confided in me and said he was such a beautiful boy, you know, had lovely eyes and that sort of thing, rather than saying she was such a beautiful girl. It was really a barrier. So the long and short of it was, the following day, when this thing had been established comfortably between him and me, and I hadn't taken a judgmental position, he said, I've had a lovely, lovely idea. You should be my personal assistant, and you can be with the boys all the time and hold Cilla Black's hand, and we'll conquer the world. And I said, well, that's wonderful. How much? And he said, well, you're on 35 a week now. I think if you were to get 50, that would be a very good increase in your increment. And I said, well, I mean, we'd have to move to London. How about 100? And he said, nonsense, and we settled for 70. But it was such a struggle in those first moments, you know, as I said in a book I wrote afterwards, that the thrall of this lovely, lovely idea lasted about 3 minutes. And once you got down to money, you were down to money. And that was the paradox of Brian, was that he was a very wonderful chap, but quite a parsimonious kind of a negotiator.
Were the Beatles comfortable with his being gay?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was something they could joke about. John was quite hard on him.
Did you have any I'm sorry.
John was quite acerbic about it and made remarks which might have been offensive had they not been friends. It was only like Jewish jokes among Jews. Not offensive because they understood. But the Beatles were extremely tolerant people. I mean, they were not... Yeah, I never heard any racial stuff there or any of that carrying on in all that time.
You didn't stay on for very long the first time that you signed up as the Beatles press agent.
Job
Why
was
did
intolerable.
You leave?
Intolerable. Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of things. You know, sometimes now I see somebody saying, I think we're going to get married. And I said, well, do you realize you're going to get divorced as well? Why don't you skip the marriage? And then you won't have to get divorced, because just think about it in 5 years' time. About the day you thought you'd nearly get married, or the day you nearly got married, and thank the Lord you took my advice. Because so many of the things we did then, Joan and I, joining the Beatles, going to live in Hollywood. Had we our time over again, we wouldn't have done that. But then again, we had some good times in it. But it was
so you kind of fell out of love with the Beatles.
I fell out of love with the job. The job was ridiculous for me to have thought that as a married man that I could devote 24 hours a day to being personal assistant to an ambitious bachelor, perhaps the most demanded man in the world. This man was top of the heap. I mean, this man could go anywhere.
Is it Brian Epstein you're
talking
about?
Yes. Uh-huh. He was as important as the Beatles in his way because he was the man behind the Beatles. He was invested in people's minds with magical powers. In fact, it was because they were what they were that both of us had joined them.
Did the Beatles put impossible demands on you?
I think that because we got on so well, it wasn't just boss and employer. You know, you were in this tight little group. And, you know, the mental strain of staying up with these four buzzing people was exhausting. It was just too much. And I had four children. So I left with relief. We immediately became friends again, Brian and I, as soon as we'd broken the spell by my resigning. I resigned at the end of the first American tour in the Riviera Motel in Kennedy Airport, watched by Bob Dylan and Gloria Steinem and sundry other...
A big scene, huh?
Luminaries. Oh, it was a big row over the use of limousines, that sort of tosh. But it was an important resignation because it showed me I could walk away from things when, really, lots of other people perhaps would have wanted to stay.
You stayed in touch with the Beatles. Let me reintroduce you before we continue. Derek Taylor is my guest, the Beatles' former press agent and author of the new book, It Was 20 Years Ago Today. You stayed in touch with the Beatles while you moved to the West Coast.
Yes.
And ended up promoting other rock groups and performers in California. But as you stayed in touch with the Beatles, did you change as they changed? And what I'm thinking here is, did you, for instance, start smoking and
yes.
dropping acid at just about the same time?
No,
that they
I was
did?
Always behind them. Really, that was behind them. And one of the things they taught me first, perhaps more important than anything, and what everyone else got from them, was you should never be afraid not to know. I mean, they showed great courage in ignorance. They say, I don't know. You know, if you ask them something they didn't know, they say, I don't know. George says in a book we did together, one of our strengths was we didn't know Hedda Hopper was important. If we'd known all those people were important, we'd never have had the gall to do the things we did. So, in other words, they simplified my complicated life. They taught me, you know, the importance of a fresh kind of an honesty, which I'd always held back. I was always impetuous and frank, but they taught me, they freed me from that. And then we had the cannabis, or marijuana, hash, that took us another level away from mundanity. Then they had LSD, and I had LSD, which they gave me.
They turned you on?
Yeah.
What was
David
that?
Crosby
what was...
gave me cannabis.
Uh-huh. Let's start.
And then they, George and John, gave Joan and me both LSD and RT in 67.
What was that day like? Did you know that you were
yes,
taking
I knew.
LSD?
Well, I didn't know that I was taking LSD, quote unquote, what it would mean. I didn't know I'd see the Scarlet Pillars and the Chartres Cathedral and all that stuff and the barbed wire growing in the window of the limo trick.
Right.
But you don't see that. Nothing happens twice. But I knew we were in for the big one sort of thing. And we were in the best of company. I knew enough about Leary to know that it was a set and setting situation. If you took it in the right mood and the right people, as I've said in the film, rather than with a load of soldiers on Grand Central Station, if you sat in a field with Linus Pauling, you'd probably be all right.
What did you do that day, the first time you got high on acid and you were with the Beatles? Did you listen to records?
Well, yes, listen to records. Also, they found me a Bösendorfer, which I notice is in the room here. I mean, I'd always played the piano as a sort of a choir boy kind of a music from way back beyond. I'd learned the piano as we all did in my generation. So we sat at the piano and sang old songs until we cracked up at how badly I was playing. And we had a lot of fun. We walked around the garden, zapped around all night. The idea was, like all travellers who'd had a good time, they wanted their friends to enjoy the sights that they had seen. And I trusted them. I was with Joan, my wife, so we were able to do it together. And, you know, it again took us into places from which we've never quite returned. Aldous Huxley said, as you remember, the man who goes through the door in the wall is never the same man who returns.
Did it change the way you heard their music to be high?
No, it didn't change that because I was, again, perhaps not concentrating as I do these days. Because I'm now a fully sober man. I don't mean I'm not born again or anything. No panics, but I don't drink. One of the things that perhaps I should have done when I took acid was stopped drinking. So my concentration wasn't as exact as it should have been. Now, I certainly like all this. Like was it, we were on before. We were on Huxley. We're now on T.S. Eliot. This is out of this book 20 years ago today. He said, the end of all our exploring will be to end up where we began and know the place for the first time. And I'm finding that more and more now. I'm able to see things properly.
I want to talk more about your work with the Beatles and also about your new book. It was 20 years ago today. But we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few seconds. My guest is Derek Taylor. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Derek Taylor is my guest. He was the press agent for the Beatles in 1964 and then became the head of publicity for Apple in 1968. He's the author of the new book, It Was 20 Years Ago Today. You left the Beatles in 64. You returned to them in late 67, early 68 to be the head of publicity for Apple Records. You've described Apple as something that was set up to administer to the Beatles' desire to save the world.
Yes,
elaborate on that.
Yes. What the idea was that it seemed, anyway, in retrospect, to have been a tax arrangement as well. That the promulgated idea was to set up physically a place where anyone could come, and if they weren't there, then I would be there with someone like me, and you'd say, "I want to write a play. I want to make a film about a cup of tea," and we would say, "Here's the money. Go and do it." And to make sure everyone knew, they went on the Johnny Carson show with Tallulah Bankhead and Joe Garagiola and announced this to an expectant nation who were delighted to hear this. I mean, practically everyone would like to do something. So and they all arrived in England. All these people arrived in England saying, let's go, man. Where's this money?
And you were responsible, right, for all those people who showed up?
I was there every day and I was working at, you know, sort of office hours, 9 to 5. So were they at the beginning. So were the Beatles. But they soon tired of this adventure.
Who are some of the more lunatic people that showed up at your door?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say that Hell's Angels were lunatics, but these people could be difficult and eccentric. They were not formal, conventional folk. And George dropped a memo in one day, which is it's been one of the books accurately quoted. And it said, while in San Francisco, I met some very nice fellows who were in the Hell's Angels, and I asked them over. When they come, please tell the staff not to be frightened and treat them well. I mean, this is the heavy chapter, and they did indeed arrive with their bikes and with Ken Kesey and with the people they call their old ladies, the women.
So what'd you do?
Put them up, took them in. I mean, this is sort of, we got to work about 9:30. I lived in a out of town, came in on the train, got in a taxi, got to work, and there's all the Hell's Angels in the lobby. Bikes sort of half in and out of this very, very smart house in Savile Row in the West End. Kesey was there demanding typewriters and access to ribbons and paper. I got to, you know, he's going to cover this thing and do his readings every morning. And we had just accommodated them. I was very, very adroit then. We'd full of acid and full of the belief that if you said it, you could do it. If you wished it, you could have it. And then we had a homeless family arrive at the same time, a mother and a father and three daughters, wanting access to John's Island. Failing that, would Paul take them to his place because they'd heard he had room in his house. And besides this, we'd got Mary Hopkin at number one with Those Were the Days. We got Billy Preston signed to the label. They were making either the White Album or Abbey Road. And there was retail, publishing, and God knows what else going on.
Is this, do you think, partly responsible for the breakup of Apple? All these people grabbing at the resources that you had?
Yes, and it has to be said that these people grabbing were nearly all invited at first. It's really like holiday invitations. You meet this lovely couple on holiday, and you invite them to come visit you when you get home, and you realize you're not in Venice anymore. You're in Anaheim. And you don't want these people you met on holiday. You don't like them. They don't look nice. And you've got nothing in common.
Philip Norman, in his book about the Beatles, Shout, quotes you as saying, in reference to the pressure at Apple, that whatever the motivation was, the effect was slavery, whatever the Beatles asked had to be done.
Yes, well, that's pretty true.
What kinds of things were asked that you felt?
Well, acorns in April. Acorns in April. Anyone would know there are no acorns left by April. The squirrels have had them. They've decayed. You know, acorns fall off the trees in the northern hemisphere in the fall, the autumn. By April, they're all gone. So when John and Yoko wanted April, I mean, this is just an example, isn't it? They called from honeymoon to say, Derek, yes, can you get us? I think 300 acorns, that's two for each of 150 world leaders. We're going to mail them off in little boxes on, you know, little sort of pads of silk or cotton wool with a message for peace, telling them to grow two trees on the banks of the Jordan, in the case of Hussein. And we send a couple extra to Moshe Dayan, and, you know, it's going to be okay. So we'll be in tomorrow afternoon. So, I mean, you know, you've got to get the acorns, not because you're frightened of them, but because this is a demand being made by reasonable people behaving unreasonably. Have I made sense of this? These are people who have had the idea in a climate of ideas come true, dreams come true. And what we should have said was, right then, there are no acorns. I would have to think of something else. We'll do it when you get back. In other words, we should have looked on it with sobriety. Instead of that, it was, right, now how can we do it? And fail. And it's much better to fail right at the beginning and say, it can't be done, John. It's not sensible.
Could you tell that the Beatles were going to break apart?
I was never that able to face up to those sort of things. No. Even when it was over, I was giving interviews on the Hoop, live satellite kind of interviews that afternoon, saying, well, it won't be for long. Because there had been difficulties. I mean, George left the Let It Be sessions, and I think John had left before. Hindsight tells us he had. And there'd been more to keep them together than to break them apart. But indeed, they did break up, as we know. And it was probably very healthy that they did, though I would rather they'd broken up in a nicer way.
My guest is Derek Taylor, who was a press agent for the Beatles and is the author of the new book, It Was 20 Years Ago Today. Your new book is about 1967, which was a big year for you. It was you were handling a lot of rock acts. You co-founded the Monterey Pop Festival, served as publicist for that. You rejoined the Beatles at the end of 1967. You know what I'm wondering with the Monterey Pop Festival? You were the press agent for that. And that was a big year in the alternative press. The alternative press was really flowering in 1967.
It was, yes.
So you had both the mainstream press, Time magazine, all the big newspapers covering the event, and the alternative press. Did the mainstream press expect to be treated differently? Did you have to decide how to treat each?
Yes, all these things are a matter of judgment all the time. My basic belief is I've always had an objection to the word important. I don't like being, not that I often am, but I don't like being described as an important guest because we're all very small, as George says in the song. And life flows on within us and without us. In other words, you know, we can all be replaced. And the LSD basis of the judgment at Monterey was that if 10 people turned up with badges from the Oracle or the LA Free Press, they were just as important as the man from Time magazine or the National Geographical magazine. The latter gave me a very hard time because he wanted a special platform for pictures. He said, you don't know how important the National Geographical magazine is. You don't know how high our standards are. I said, indeed I do. I love the magazine. But this is an unusual festival. This is egalitarianism being acted out in front of you. And you're all going to get badges and you won't all get in. And the choice is either you hand your badges back and I'll allocate them according to seats available, or I'll give you too many and you can fight it out. But if you've got any sense, you'll share. There are 7 concerts-ish, I think, however many there were. And you won't all see them all, unless you're really clever. And you should have bought tickets anyway, you daft buggers. So I dealt with it by moving very quickly through, and with great sincerity and some charm, we got away with it just because the mood was so good and the festival so excellent that we really couldn't be faulted. Everything was moving very quickly. And the press releases at the time, I thought, were, looking back, a pretty good get out if I was nailed for, you know, for being irresponsible, because there were too many journalists there. There were 1,100. But, I mean, the Oracle had done so much more for the counterculture than, for instance, the National Geographical magazine, that they deserve the facilities.
You know what I'm wondering? The media, in a lot of ways, and it's ironic, I mean, we're both involved with the media, but the media, in a lot of ways, has turned a lot of the late 1960s into a series of clichés.
They didn't understand it then.
Well, yeah, you were talking to people from the press who weren't a part of the counterculture, and it was so exclusive then. If you were on the outside, you weren't likely to be understanding
what
it was about.
It's to their credit that although they didn't understand it, it seemed so pleasant that they didn't attack us. At that focal point in the middle of June when the Beatles were Sgt. Peppering, they were nice to us, but they still didn't understand what the hell was going on, or why we were wearing these weird clothes.
Did you have to try to explain things to
them? No, I said, this is how it is. Mm-hmm. If we look changed, we are. But, look, am I mad? Yes, probably, but I can still run a festival. And the proof was that we did. I mean, it is there on film, an orderly, wonderful pop festival.
Do you feel involved at all in the media cliché of the late 60s? You know, since you were working with the press so closely, do you feel like you had a part in that?
No. I don't feel that at all. Because by the time I got to 67, I was sort of alienated from an outside and from an external view. I was a participant rather than a reporter. And I never really returned to a question. I never really became a questioner anymore. I became more of a doer.
You had a chance to see a lot of people who were very active in the counterculture in the late 60s for the film and for the book. It was 20
yes.
years ago today. And the people who were at the forefront of what was described as the youth culture are now gray-haired and a lot older. What were some of the emotional things you were feeling seeing them and writing the book about 1967?
Well, I felt that they were good examples of what we were on about. I mean, there were so few betrayals among the people we met. No betrayals among the people we interviewed. Abby Hoffman was still being Abby Hoffman. In fact, as long after the book was written, he was standing trial with Amy. And Peter Coyote was a successful actor, but not doing anyone in. Got a very good reputation for being nice to the help.
We only have a few seconds left. I guess, are you nostalgic for that period, or do you think it was just important and now it's
it was
over
great.
And
no,
on
I'm
to something
not,
else?
Oh, yes. I'm not nostalgic, but it's nice to be able to record it. It's an honor and a privilege, really.
Well, we're out of time, I regret to say. Derek Taylor, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Derek Taylor. He was a press agent for the Beatles in 1964 and then after 1968. He's written a new book about 1967, the year that Sgt. Pepper was released. It's titled It Was 20 Years Ago Today, and it's published by Fireside Books. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll have a live concert with pianist and composer Jackie Byard. He's performed with musicians like Charles Mingus and Eric Dolphy and now leads his own big band in New York. He also wrote and performs the theme music for Fresh Air, so I hope you can join us.
1, 2
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, author and director Michael Crichton talks about the power of the imagination. His thrillers, The Andromeda Strain, The Terminal Man, and his new novel, Sphere, draw on our curiosity about and fear of the unknown. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews River's Edge, starring Crispin Glover and Dennis Hopper. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Famous Blue Raincoat, Jennifer Warren's recording of Leonard Cohen's songs, and we'll have a news update from National Public Radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have the news. This is Fresh Air. Each week, our rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album, but this week he has an album that's not exactly new, but it's only just caught on. It features Jennifer Warnes singing the songs of Leonard Cohen.
The flames, they followed Joan of Arc. She came riding through the dark. No moon to keep her armor bright. No man to get her through this dark and smoky night.
6 months is a lifetime in popular music. Records arrive with great fanfare, become immortal hits, and wither into golden oldies in the space of half a year. However, I'm here to talk about a happy exception to this rule. 6 months ago, singer Jennifer Warnes released an album called Famous Blue Raincoat, in which she sang 9 tunes written by the Canadian poet and songwriter Leonard Cohen. Warnes has had some hits in her time, such as her duet with Joe Cocker, Up Where We Belong. That's the Treacly theme song from the Treacly movie An Officer and a Gentleman. But this Leonard Cohen project didn't sound like a potential smash hit to the record companies she approached. Finally, a small label called Cypress Records released the album. Famous Blue Raincoat got good to glowing reviews, but even its biggest fans expected it to be just a cult favorite, an album enjoyed by a small circle of friends, here today, gone tomorrow. Now, 6 months later, comes news that Famous Blue Raincoat has, in the language of the biz, gone gold. Sold over 500,000 copies, more than anything Jennifer Warnes has sold before, and way more than Leonard Cohen ever sold of his own records. As a popular and artistic success, Famous Blue Raincoat deserves attention. Here's Jennifer Warnes singing her version of one of Leonard Cohen's most well-known songs, Bird on a Wire.
Thank you.
That was Jennifer Warren singing Leonard Cohen's song Bird on a Wire. Those of you familiar with the two best-known versions of that song, Tim Hardin's and Leonard Cohen's own version, may be surprised or even appalled by Jennifer Warren's drastic overhaul of that song, which is usually sung as a kind of baleful dirge. Nonetheless, Warren's radical reinterpretations have the blessing of the song's author. Leonard Cohen worked closely on this project with Warren's, sings with her on one song, and even wrote the admiring liner notes. It may well be that Leonard Cohen realized that what Jennifer Warren's was doing was giving new life to his work, forcing skeptics like me to confront him in a new light. To me, Cohen has always been a drippy drag, his songs little more than solemn processions of doomed lovers, grieving families, and alienated deep thinkers. Anyone who can come up with metaphorical howlers like hair upon your pillow like a sleepy golden storm is a man I want to keep at arm's length and ear's length. But hearing Warren's tear through Leonard Cohen so enthusiastically has changed my mind to some extent. What Warren's has done is rethink those Leonard Cohen lyrics, to sing them and arrange them in a way that drains off all the self-pity and wet-blanket romanticism. This is, I think, a classic example of the way pop singing can impart sense to words that actually make very little sense at all. Jennifer Warren's gives Leonard Cohen's work an emotional truth it hasn't possessed before. And what does it mean that this collection of stately, rather obscure pop music has sold more than 500,000 records? Very little, perhaps. It might be just one more sign that the pop audience is getting older and is seeking out calm voices and so-called good singing, as opposed to that loud rock and roll stuff. Or it might mean that people are actually going for intelligent records like this, that there's an increasing sophistication among pop fans who are learning that you have to look beyond what's on the radio or in the top 10 to appreciate the best in music these days. Either way, Famous Blue Raincoat is the best break Leonard Cohen ever got.
Ken Tucker reviewed Jennifer Warren's album, Famous Blue Raincoat. He writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
I came so far for beauty. I left so much behind. My patience and my family, my masterpiece unsigned. I thought I'd be rewarded for such a lonely choice. It may be he...
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Crichton. He's the author of The Andromeda Strain and The Terminal Man, best-selling science fiction books that were made into movies. He began writing under a pen name to pay his way through medical school. He received his degree but left medicine to continue writing more novels, nonfiction, and screenplays. And he's directed two science fiction hits, Westworld, from his own script, and Coma, based on the Robin Cook novel. Michael Crichton's new novel, Sphere, explores the fears created by our own imaginations. I asked him why he chose this theme.
It seemed to me that for a long time I had an interest in doing a book that was about contact with an alien intelligence that was greater than our own. And I began to wonder what it might really be like. And I was also very interested in the possibility that such a contact might bring to the surface or make us become aware of aspects of ourselves that we don't ordinarily think about. And one of those aspects is our ability to imagine all kinds of things, positive things, negative things, and we just imagine as easily as we breathe. I mean, we're imagining all the time.
You seem to think that if we didn't have the means to repress our imagination and our thoughts, we'd all be pretty weird and pretty vicious.
I certainly think it's true that we all have a sort of stream of thought going on, which we tend to deny. You know, we all tend to present ourselves in a certain kind of a light, and the parts of ourselves which may be angry or aggressive or antagonistic or destructive, we tend as a society to say that's not there, to say, oh, I'm not that way, oh, no. The fact that we ignore it means that it can be free in a way that it might not be free, that it can get away from us.
Your novel is also about how people project dangerous powers onto technology. Do you think, and specifically, I think you're thinking of computers, do you think we have irrational fears about computers?
Yes, I do. And I think we have irrational hopes as well. Computers, because they seem so mysterious, and I think also because they're still quite new, offer us the opportunity to project onto them our fantasies, or it presents this possibility of being some dark, sinister, big brother force. And in fact, it's just these little circuits with little electrons running through them. There's nothing much else to them.
Are there any particularly absurd fantasies that you've heard, negative or positive, about computers?
I think that the silliest fantasy was a positive one, in which people thought that you could make computer programs to serve as psychiatrists, and that we could all sort of hunker down in front of the terminal and tell the terminal our problems and it would answer us, and that we would move forward and become better, warmer, richer human beings as a result of our contact with the computer shrink. I mean, that seems to me about as dumb as anything I've ever heard.
In your novel, there's a sphere that appears to be from another universe. You have your main characters near it, waiting for some being from another planet to walk out, and they're expecting, oh my God, what if it's a huge reptile or a giant insect? And then they realize what we're thinking about is the movies. These are the expectations we have from films. Do you think that movies have really shaped our imagination and our fears?
Yes, I think absolutely. I think that one of the things that I wanted to do in this book was to represent a group of people who are, in a sense, post-literary. I mean, they are people whose psychological underpinnings and whose imagery, the imagery that they have available to them is imagery from things that they've seen, not things that they've read. And I think that's increasingly true of people in our society.
It's funny, we're talking about how movies create certain fears in the people who watch them, and you've added a few of your own. I guess I'm thinking especially of the Andromeda strain, the idea of a virus from another planet coming down to infect us.
I guess the exploration of fears is, to me, a very important activity in terms of being able to release them. And also, on some level, which I'm not entirely clear about, it's very fun to be scared in the movies. You know, I mean, I think that it's tremendously enjoyable to think about a new virus when it's the Andromeda strain, and it's tremendously unenjoyable when it's the AIDS virus, you know. And I think in a certain way that the function of fantasy is to let us make certain kinds of explorations that we're not free to make in real life because they're too painful.
What were the movies that most influenced you when you were young?
I think that almost without question, they were all Walt Disney movies. Only in the last year did I finally work up the nerve to get a videotape of Pinocchio and run it.
What scared you about Pinocchio?
It's so scary.
What's so scary about Pinocchio?
Well, you know, I looked at it and I couldn't find what was scary. I looked at it and thought, gee, was this the scary part? I don't know. I don't know whether it was the boys being turned into donkeys. I don't know what that was. And I know that Fantasia terrified me, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and, you know, Mickey Mouse and the brooms that wouldn't stop. That was very frightening to me.
You know, in a way, this is really the big lie about keeping your children away from scary movies, because Disney, which is, you know, certified as terrific for kids, is actually very scary to a lot of kids, right?
Terrifying.
These movies scare the heck out of you, or they really made you cry. Are you sorry you saw them?
No.
So that's the thing. So it must be wonderful for kids to be scared.
Absolutely.
Movies. Yeah.
Sure.
You got started as a writer and then ended up directing movies, some of which were adapted from your own novels, like Westworld, The Great Train Robbery, and then you directed Coma, which is based on a Robin Cook novel.
Yes.
How did you end up in directing? How did you make that transition from writing?
When they were shooting The Andromeda Strain, I went on the set to look at it because I was tremendously interested in movies and I wanted to see what was done. And I looked at the process and I thought, I can do this. I don't know how to explain it. I just looked at it and I thought, I can do this. And then while I was trying to do it, other people were making versions of my books. There was a film of The Terminal Man, which I was very upset about. You know, I had always thought that writers who said that they were physically ill at the sight of the movies that were made from their books were exaggerating or that they were being indulgent. But I actually had to leave the theater. I was sick to my stomach. And so in part, it was also an attempt to protect my work or to do it the way that I wanted it to be done.
What scares you now in books or movies? You were telling us how frightened you still are thinking about your reactions to Pinocchio and other Walt Disney movies. Does anything have that powerful an effect on you now?
Yes, there is something. I think from time to time I see films where I know the people who made them, and I know that they're doing something which is meretricious. They're doing something which is violent when they don't believe in violence. They're doing something which is inhuman or anti-human or something which is incongruent with the kind of people that they are, and they know the kind of message they're putting out into the society, and they know the potential destructiveness of that message, and they know what they're contributing to, and they're doing it anyway, and that terrifies me.
This is a different level of fear.
Yes, this is a different level. Exactly right.
Is this something you're afraid of yourself? You're afraid of becoming because you've seen it happen to others?
No, that's interesting. I'm not afraid of doing that myself. You sometimes wonder if you'll ever work, I mean, if you won't do that. I mean, an awful lot of the movies that I see now seem to be MTVs for violence. You know, they seem to make them look really terrific as we maim and slaughter and destroy people. And that just doesn't seem to me to be right and worth doing. And I think that when people have tremendous visual sophistication and tremendous skills, that it ought not to be used in the service of rape, murder, and mayhem. I just think that on some level we have a responsibility.
It's kind of a funny thing to say from someone who writes suspense novels and science fiction.
Well, there's suspense and suspense, you know, and I think that, I don't know, I mean, on one level, I think I'm very often accused of being too much the other way. I mean, there's a sort of didactic schoolmarmish quality or a moralistic aspect to a lot of what I write that certain people complain about, but I guess it's my way of doing it the way I think it ought to be done.
Michael Crichton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Crichton's new book is called Sphere. He spoke to us from the NPR studios in New York. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
The International AIDS Conference is continuing in Washington. Will you have an update?
We sure will, from Richard Harris and others. Also, we'll be covering the return of Albert Hakim to the witness stand in the Iran-Contra hearings, and a piece about the defense contracting from WedTech in the South Bronx that's at the center of that racketeering scandal.
I don't want to sound like a complainer, but yesterday you folks promised us a piece on small cows, and you didn't deliver.
You're right. We didn't deliver. In the press of events, our piece on small cows had to be delayed. This evening, the small cows saga will be on All Things Considered.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. River's Edge is a new movie starring Dennis Hopper and Crispin Glover. Our film critic Stephen Schiff says the subject matter is disturbing, but the movie's not very compelling.
At the beginning of River's Edge, a big Lummoxy high school kid kills his girlfriend and leaves her naked corpse lying by the riverside. His buddies come to see it. They discuss the crime, trying to figure out why they don't feel anything much about it. They poke at the body with sticks. Above all, They decide not to narc on the killer, not to go to the police. All of this vaguely gruesome stuff takes place under dreary gray skies in some unidentified West Coast town. The kids there are all doped up on something or other, and so are their little brothers and sisters, and so are their moms and dads. It's a pretty grim vision. And the movie has thrown a lot of critics into a spin. Some of my colleagues seem to think River's Edge is this year's big cult film event, the Blue Velvet of 1987, only they like it better. Blue Velvet, after all, was strange and stylish and hard to take, whereas River's Edge has the reassuring look of a concerned, liberal art film. It's disturbing, all right, but not in any way that gets under your skin. You can probably tell I'm not on the River's Edge bandwagon. I respect its grittiness, and at the beginning I respected its refusal to soften any of the incidents it depicts. I enjoyed a few scenes like this one, in which the blasé teens are interviewed for TV.
I think they should have arrested John.
John?
Well, he killed Jamie.
You knew the killer?
Yeah. You know, we both kind of knew the killer. You know, as well as, or in addition to, you know, who he killed, too. And, you know, because of that, it's pretty hard for us to be,
objective?
Yeah, that's it, objective. You know, since we did know the two alleged people involved and everything. You know, and whereas we might be all, you know, upset this morning or something, you know, we're not because of the fact that we're not objective at all. I also play guitar, by the way.
That's a familiar sequence, but nicely handled. And yet, River's Edge has two big problems. The first is the most egregious case of miscasting I've seen in years, that of Crispin Glover in the crucial role of the gang leader. You'll remember Glover as the nerdy father in Back to the Future. And if you think that makes him an odd choice as a charismatic youth chieftain, you're right. He's just as nerdy here, and just as mannered and theatrical and uncool. I found it impossible to believe that these tough, streetwise kids would follow him anywhere. But I was even more bothered by the film's fuzzy-minded preachiness. Here's a movie that depends on feelings we probably already have before the movie begins. We're bound to be shocked by the murder, and then we're bound to be even more shocked because the kids on screen feel nothing. So, why is it that about halfway through, the director, Tim Hunter, seems to grab us by the shoulders and start yelling, "You should be shocked by this! Why aren't you shocked? Why doesn't anybody care?" The thing is, we do care. In fact, the movie would have a lot more impact if we were allowed to sit and experience our own dismay, instead of having the filmmakers beat that dismay into us. After a while, the whole film comes to seem annoying, and even trivial. You want to brush it off, which is a real shame. River's Edge is based on incidents that actually happened a few years ago in Milpitas, California. Almost everyone who heard about them responded with horror. Strangely enough, people who see River's Edge may wind up feeling less about the crime when they walk out of the theater than they did when they walked in.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair.
That's it? He murders Jamie and we just ignore it?
He had his reasons. She was shooting her mouth off about his mom.
His mother's dead.
Yeah. See?
He's got a couple loose springs when it comes to dealing with his dead mother.
But he comes to school bragging. It's like he wants to get caught.
Well, he's not going to get caught because no one's going to tell. Isn't that right, Tony?
Here's what's coming up on our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with film sound designer Alan Splett. He did the sound for the David Lynch movies Blue Velvet, Elephant Man, and Eraserhead. Coinciding with the Chicago Blues Festival, Chicago bluesman Homesick James will show off his slide guitar style, and critic at large Laurie Stone will review two plays that explore sexual relations. She says the specter of AIDS colored her view of both. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of Philadelphia's business and cultural district. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance today from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.